Hey everyone, just before we begin this week's episode, I have a quick favour to ask you all. If you love the show, it would mean so much if you could take a moment to follow or subscribe wherever you're listening to right now, or share it with a friend, tell them all about it, or leave a quick comment. And when you see the videos on social media, please comment there too, because it really, really helps me to keep this podcast going. Thank you all so, so much.
We all know how valuable photos and video clips of a loved one are. But have you thought about capturing their full story in their own words as an audio podcast or as a video? At GK Media, we've been working with families, hospices and nursing homes across Ireland over the past 10 years to help preserve precious memories. We help you celebrate the voices, special moments and wisdom of your loved ones by recording your meaningful conversations together. Record in our Galway studio, or we can travel to you bringing our own recording equipment. Whether it's a tribute, life story, or message for future generations, we capture it with care and compassion. Visit gkmedia.ie/legacy and let us help you tell the story that deserves to be remembered.
Hi, so we're back again this week with Helen Grorick. Hi, Helen, how are you?
Hi,
you're
how
so
are
welcome.
You? Thank you so much. I'm very honoured to be here.
Oh, so yeah, you have come you. This morning from Meath. You're from Meath?
Yeah, from Meath. So yeah,
born and raised.
Took a few trips to Australia and London, but yeah, Meath. I've been back home for quite some time.
Very good. Yeah. And so I obviously am delighted to have you here today, and we're going to talk a little bit about you and your whole story of your loss that you have experienced, which is a little bit we'll get into in a little while. But I suppose to start off, to just maybe tell me about your family of origin, where you came from and who was in that family.
Yeah, of course. So I suppose I was, you know, I come from Clemestan, a little village in Meath, and my mom and dad, Ada and Phelim. And I have a brother, Aidan, and a sister, Niamh. Very normal, typical family. We were raised with a lot of openness and love. And that came from Mom, certainly not Dad. Dad's very typical Irish man. He, you know, was very, probably Mom and Dad are like chalk and cheese. He's quite quiet and Mom's the talker. She talked for him all the time. And yeah, we were raised with a lot of love and compassion and empathy. And as I said, that came from Mom. She was, she came from a family of six and she grew up with five brothers, which she absolutely idolized and adored. And she had her mom there as well and her dad, but she was an only girl in the family. And so she had no sisters. So she loved having brothers, but I think she had that special relationship with her mom because she had no sisters. And I think when she had two daughters of her own, there was an incredible bond between myself, my mom, and my sister Niamh. She used to call us the baby girls, and she just loved having girls and everything that came with that.
Poor Aidan.
Yeah, he was raised like a girl. Yeah, very
sure
soft.
He was a mommy's boy too.
Oh yeah, big time. Aidan could do no wrong. But yeah, we had a very, very nice life growing up. You know, lots of fun living in the house. Mom was very, she was great at entertaining. You know, she was just this type of person who always had people around. Our house, we used to laugh, it was like Euston Station, because you just have people coming in and out. You know, you get up in the morning, there could be someone sitting there, Joe, whatever, blog, sitting there having a cup of tea. And she always had her brothers around and all the extended family. And there was, you know, birthdays, Christmas. It was just that type of house where it was very much everybody's welcome, you know, open door policy. And it was very much love. Like she just cooking, feeding everybody, running around, being a busy mom. She just was a carer, you know.
Lovely.
She was just that type of person. And, yeah, she just was a very funny person as well. Great sense of humor. But she grew up and she left school when she was about 14, and she actually got into retail management and stuff like that I know it's something she regretted later on in life, leaving school early, because she was really smart. She was very good with numbers. But she developed a love for people from that, from working with the public, from being in front of the public. And that's what ultimately kind of grew in her, with just chatting. And she was very like her dad. Her dad was heavily involved in football, you know, gammon, and very much like couldn't go anywhere without knowing Mickey Morris, this kind of thing. And my mom became that person. She knew everybody around where she lived in Bective and stuff like that. And, you know, she met my dad and they courted for a number of years, as you do. They got married anyway. But to describe what happened really with my mom, to give a context to the type of person she was, her mom died quite young. So her mom died when she was 50. Mom would have been about 25 or 26. And we were, myself and Aidan were 3 and 5. And that shaped who she was as a person. She was so close to her mom, as I mentioned earlier about the relationship of not having a sister. That was something that she never got over. And I never really understood either, you know, to this day.
Yeah,
you know,
of course.
Well, to this day I do, but, you know, throughout the years of growing up, mom would be crying at any given reason. Oh, she's crying again about Nana. And because we were so young, we didn't understand the loss. But now, being a mom of two myself, I get how busy her life was. You know, she had us two, myself and Aidan. Eve hadn't come along that time. And she had two younger brothers. There was a big age gap, Mikey and Colin, who were there. They were 9 and 12. And they kind of grew up like as part of our family, because mom stepped in to help raise with granddad, which was lovely for her, because she was such a nurturer. Wow. And she did all the things like getting them, helping them with all the school stuff, all that kind of mom stuff she did.
So as you were growing up, your mom's health, I suppose, was all good, was it? Fit and healthy? Sounded it anyway, fit and healthy.
She was very fit and healthy. She was running around, she'd lots of energy, she needed lots of energy, she had a lot going on. Like my dad, you know, growing up, as we were growing up, he was diagnosed with bipolar. And my brother had some asthma issues, and my sister had a car accident, and she had a lot of stuff going on. I would say very fit physically, but mentally there was an awful lot of load, trauma that had transpired over the years. But she was doing, you know, good. Do you know that? She was very resilient. No conditions. She's a tough woman, like, you know. But she was diagnosed with COPD
In 2018,
and we didn't think too much about it, because she'd always had chest kind of things, and it was a hereditary in the family, you know, having these kind of chest issues. So it wasn't groundbreaking. We weren't in the, you know, worried stage at that point. Fast forward on to 2022, say in around that, she had, it would started off with a bowel surgery. This kind of really kicked off her, the worst thing, and the decline of her health, because they left, after the bowel surgery, she was left with fluid on her lungs, and that exacerbated the COPD.
Oh, wow.
And it was kind of around then that it got worse. And it was around her 60th birthday. She was really, you know, relatively young. But she was then told that it was stage 4. And at the time, you know, when we were told that, and when she told us that, like, I suppose it's different to, say, a cancer diagnosis, because it's very cut and dry as to maybe what might happen next. But with COPD, you can live on for years, and it depends on the person. And we'd seen my granddad be sick in later life, and he just kicked on. He was like the cat with 9 lives. He just, you know, he was in and out of hospital, but he just continued to keep going. So I think intuitively, we all felt mom would be like that. So that was kind of the start of it.
Just for the listeners, I suppose, COPD, I obviously know
it's a lung disease, basically.
Do you know what the COPD stands for? I know it's pulmonary disease.
Yeah, I can never get the
but it's a lung disease.
It is a lung disease, yeah.
Okay. And so obviously, as you're explaining it there, there's different stages. I didn't realize
there's
that.
Different
kind of
stages.
Stage 1,
yeah.
2, 3,
yeah,
4.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. So she was at stage 4.
Which is more advanced?
It's the more advanced. Okay. But as I mentioned, that can continue on for a long time. And there is steps and there is support there to help that continuation.
So can I ask, so in 2022, that's when they said that she was stage four. Yeah. What were you seeing in her? Were you seeing more coughing?
So basically what was happening, it was a huge deterioration in her health. You know, she was struggling to breathe. Wow. It was really hard. She was struggling to do everyday tasks like get, you know, dressed, get up out of the bed, sleeping, like all these things that you or I would take for granted were starting to become quite arduous and harder for her. So she started to, from then on, have a lot of hospital visits. So the hospital visits were becoming very frequent, less time in between. And she was going into her local hospital, which was amazing because it was close by and she was able to go in, kind of get her stats back normal, get her, you know, what was happening was she was getting infections. And every time she got an infection, they had to, you know, monitor that and try to get it to kind of a better situation. So then they started with, you know, the support and things that they can do, which was really hard for mom because she was a fiercely independent woman, like really, really independent. Like she did everything for herself. She wasn't the type of person to take any help from anyone. So to start to rely on, say, my dad and us and things like that was really, really hard. The first thing that kind of came was oxygen. So that's something that's a part of the COPD that you have oxygen at home. Mm. So with every kind of support thing that she was given, we got a bit of hope because we thought, okay, you know, and each time it was for her, she had to mourn a bit of a period of, right, this is the next stage for me. And she did great. Like she had a good attitude. She had a positive attitude with it, but she was tired. She was tired with constantly being strong, you know, being positive about what's the next step. So the oxygen gave her a bit of breathing space.
Mm.
That helped. She had oxygen, you know, into her nose and stuff. And she used it as needed. But the hospital visits, as I mentioned, they were getting really frequent. She had about 19 hospital visits, like it was full on. And it was hard because we couldn't go in to see her all the time. It was still around COVID kind of had, you know, petered out a little bit, but it was still very much, there was a worry about going in and seeing her and stuff like that and spreading infections. So we were often, you know, seen hanging out the window at Navan, chatting to her and, you know, bringing her up chocolate because she was, you know, she had her love for her chocolate. But, you know, she was lucky in that sense because she was beside the hospital and they were amazing. So the oxygen helped her for a number of months. And then it was the next step was a wheelchair, which that was really hard because that was ultimately her independence, you know, physically walking.
So in terms of going from this fit mom bursting around the house and then all of a sudden she has to go into a wheelchair, is that because all the breath, she's physically wasn't able to walk with her breath?
Yeah, it got that bad. So she had tightness. She literally couldn't walk. You know, she was getting to the point where, you know, she loved her shopping. Like, I mean, this woman shopped, you know, for all her grandkids. She was a shopper and she couldn't walk around the shops. Like that was, you know, that was her thing of, you know, even just doing a grocery shop or whatever. And like, sure, my dad wouldn't have a clue, like, to go out and do the food shop. She took control of everything. So that was the initial stages. And she had to get used to that. That was a defining moment in the disease for her because that was just pivotal of just how it changed drastically. Like, you know, we had funny moments with it. We went into the shopping centre one day and it was her first time actually using it in public. And I said, come on, we need to get you out and shopping. Like she loved buying for the grandkids. Like she was mad into horse racing and she'd win money in the horses. Oh, she was the
Galway
races. Yeah. She was very lucky, very lucky. She'd put like a euro or €2 each way. Like she was very frugal, gambler, better, whatever you want to call it. She wouldn't spend much, but she just loved the fun of it. And she used to make great money. She loved it. She absolutely loved it. Anyway, she'd get the winnings and it was a running joke. The minute they were in her account, she was buying for all the grandkids. So we brought her in shopping and dad took the wheelchair out of the car. And up until this point, I guess none of us were we were still, I don't know why, I looking back on it now, it seems so surreal, but we were still not, it wasn't clicking that this was getting bad, you know? But it was Dad took out the wheelchair and I broke down then because Mom was still in the car and I thought, this is my mom and I'm, you know, like this is for someone much older. This, in my head, this was what I was thinking. But I pulled it together quickly and I said, we're going to have a good day. Got her into the wheelchair and we had such a laugh. I'm a terrible driver and I was literally knocking her into everything. So we're in the shopping centre and we'd good crack. And as I said, like she had such humour with it too. And once he got into her laughing about something, she'd the best laugh. Like she'd be cackling away and we'd great fun. We shopped and that got her through kind of, right, I can go in public. Because I was, myself and Eve and Aidan, we were trying to convince her that just because you're in a wheelchair doesn't take away who you are. It doesn't take your identity away. You still need to do all the things that you love. And she got a bit of confidence with that and that gave her a bit of hope and stuff like that. So that went on, you know, for a few months and the hospital visit still continued, but it was getting worse. It was still getting worse. It was getting worse at nighttime. It was hard, you know, she was really struggling to cope because of the breathing. Like the way she described to me, you know, gasping for her breath. It was just, you know, during the night. So the nighttime was particularly bad. She wasn't sleeping well.
And why is the night so bad?
Just because she's lying down and it was just,
okay.
I don't know.
So much harder to breathe,
I guess. So yeah, so they introduced a PAP machine and that was, we thought this was going to be it, you know.
Yeah.
With the oxygen, with the wheelchair and then the PAP machine. And a PAP machine is, it can be used for sleep apnea.
Yeah.
You know, horrible, like a horrible thing to sleep with, to
is
be
it?
Fair. Yeah, yeah. It's like she found it really hard because, you know, if you wanted to get up and have a drink during the night, it was like this big mat, like it was quite uncomfortable. But again, she got used to it. She was so tough, like whatever they asked her to do in the hospital in terms of like, the support she was given, she was doing it and she was getting it, cracking on with it, and she was still doing everyday life and still looking after everybody, worrying about everybody, all the things moms do, you know. That gave her a bit of a lifeline, I guess. And then that takes us kind of up to, you know, around Christmas time. And she was really quite bad at this point.
Was she bedbound? Like
No.
At home.
She was just at home. She wasn't bedbound, but it was just the hospital visits were getting. Basically, to give a kind of background, with her disease, she could get an infection at any time and die because she wouldn't, sometimes she might not respond to their treatment, to the steroids. She was taking steroids, you know, to beat the band. She was in and out of hospital and they said to us, look, it's going to get to a point where this might not work. And the hospice then was introduced. And when the hospice was introduced, that was quite scary at first. Because anyone that hears hospice, they think imminent death, that kind of thing. But I will say they were amazing. Things that I didn't realise a hospice done, but they centred her around her life and positivity and, you know, gratitude and all these things that were starting to fail a bit in her because obviously she was in pain, she was struggling, you know, it was getting hard, it was getting very hard. But they were amazing and they gave her a lot of skills to try and, you know, dig deep, I guess.
Were they home visits or?
Home visits. And she loved the ladies that came to the house. And I spoke to a couple of them. So did my sister. They were lovely, just very nice. Like such an amazing occupation, really. They're angels, like, you know, because they give those people peace at the end of their life. But Christmas time came anyway, and she was like, this is my last Christmas. And
so did you really feel at that point that she...
But we thought, like, honestly, Kathy, we thought... We still were like, no, you're grand. Now, she talked a lot about death to me because me and her had a relationship. We were very straight with each other. There was no nonsense. She wouldn't speak to my sister Niamh about it because Niamh was the baby and she, like, Niamh was very scared of mom dying. But me and her had a kind of, she'd want to talk about her funeral. She wanted to say who was going to be there and who wasn't going to be there and what food to have and what to do. She gave me all these instructions. And we used to laugh and it was nice. That was my way of coping and her way of coping because she was fiercely organized. If you've seen her, she always had a book in her hand and she was writing down, you know, lists of presents or money or whatever. Mm. She was organized. So she was going to be organized in death.
Mm.
You know, that was for sure. But I still felt that it's going to not be soon. Like,
okay.
You know, I wasn't feeling it was going to be soon. But anyway, Christmas, one of the times actually she was taken to hospital. It was in August, just before the Christmas. And the ambulance guys came in and they knew Mam at this point because they'd been coming in a lot to the house. A man was sitting at the table with Christmas presents in August, wrapping them. And the ambulance guy said, he goes, Ada, I don't think it's Navin, you know, general, we need to bring you. I think we need to bring you to a psych ward because what are you doing? Like, do you know what I mean? So she, to give context of Christmas coming, she was Christmas mad. January every year, she shopped the whole year round. So she thought it was her last Christmas. She made a big hoo-ha about this. She went to town. I mean, she went to town on all the grandkids, on all of us. Christmas Eve, we stayed with me and my family, Kieran and my two kids. And me and Mam had a great night. We sat up drinking wine, chatting, laughing, crying, talking about funerals, talking about this process and what had happened. And just real Irish way of death, I guess, you know, like we immersed ourselves in it. And we got up Christmas Day and we had a lovely Christmas Day. All our brothers came over, huge family gathering. But she wasn't well. She managed to do that whole dinner, you know, with all the illness and everything, and with a small bit of a hangover too. But that's what she wanted, you know, and we had a lovely day. But then a couple of days after Christmas, my brother's ex-partner, who we had two beautiful kids with, she suddenly passed away very unexpectedly. And that hit Mom very hard because Mom, you know, she was worried about Aiden. She was worried about the kids and she couldn't be there the way she would normally be. Like she was, you know, she used to mind my son Dylan for 2 days a week and she was always very active with the grandkids. She loved the grandkids. They were her life. So that was a huge thing for her and the worry of that. So that was quite difficult to deal with in the months coming up, but she was declining mentally, physically. But we had some good moments, you know, in those kind of six months. There was a couple of poignant things that we got to do. And it was like she knew she was gone and there was a few things that we got to do before she was gone because she in her head believed even though we weren't there, she was there. She knew what was going to happen. I was going to bring my sister Niamh and my mom away for a night for her 60th and 30th, but we never got to do that because Mom had been sick. And we were going to do it in the summer. I was on maternity and I thought, I'll wait till the summer, you know, money-wise, I can do something really big. But something in me intuitively was like, I need to do this now. So in the April, we went to a local hotel and we had the best night, wheelchair and all, oxygen, everything. And we had just the crack. It was a brilliant night. And again, it was like, she just knew. And I knew intuitively, even though I wasn't there yet. So there was that and, you know, she did one last shopping trip. She arrived at my house like Lazarus with all these shopping bags. And I nearly died. I actually started crying when she came to the door. I was like, what are you doing here? Like, because she hadn't been on her own in a car driving like for a year maybe. And she'd done her last hoolie for the kids. I mean, throngs of bags. Like it was crazy. It was crazy. And I have a lovely video of her and my son he was her little golden boy. And that's so important because, you know, now that's all you have. So there was that, and that was kind of it. And then it kind of took us up to the May. I was going to Mayo. My husband's from Mayo, Kieran. We were going to a christening. My nephew, Kieran's nephew, was getting christened, and Mom was like, go to the christening. She was all about family. She loved Brendan Nashin, who was their parents, and she was like, you have to go, just go to the christening. But she ended up in hospital that weekend, and I knew something, like I knew wasn't right. I knew that this was not good because she was very bad this time. My sister rang me and said, look, I think, you know, maybe come back. Mom's been moved to ICU. And they had kind of said to us all along, if she gets to ICU, you know, that's not good for her. It's not a good situation. You know, does she want to be resuscitated? These kind of questions were being asked. So we knew that that's not good, you know. So I came home that evening, the Sunday, I think it was a Sunday, went in to see her, and mam being mam, she was trying to talk, you know, because she's a chatterbox. Like, you couldn't shut the woman up. Like, honestly, she talked for Ireland. We love that about her. Hate it sometimes, but we love that about her. And she was trying to take off her mask to talk to me and Niamh, and, you know, we were trying to chat to her. And we were there with her for ages. And then eventually the nurse was like, you two need to go because your mom is mad to talk to you. And like, it's causing her stats to go up and, you know, she's getting exasperated. You just need to kind of get out of here. And we were laughing at this because it was very much, you know, our relationship, the three of us chatting, like. And as I was walking out the door, my last thing that I said to her, I was going on a hen party on the Friday to Portugal for one of my best friends is getting married. And I, you know, done all the shopping. I packed the bags of two kids. I was like, this is going to be great, you know, getting away for the weekend. And I said to mum, I said, you better not let me miss this hen party. Messing with her. And she roared laughing. She was nearly, you know, the mask and everything. She laughing and she just gave me a kiss and went out the door. And she still had her humour. Do you know what I mean? Like, at that point, I was like, she's okay. So next morning, 6 o'clock, we got a call and Niamh called me and Niamh was like saying to me, going to bed, she goes, put on your phone because I'm a devil for not having the phone turned on. It's always on silent. No one can get me. She's like, make sure you get your phone on. They rang me 6 o'clock. We went in and they were like, look, you need to get everyone in here. She's not going to come out of this. And she was not speaking at this point. She was, you know, unconscious or whatever. And then all her family came in. And it was beautiful for her because she had huge family from my dad's side of the family and her side of the family. Dad has five brothers. She had five brothers and all their wives and extended. Everybody was there. And she would have loved that. She would have loved the drama of us all there around her and surrounding her with love. And she fought all day until everybody was there, until everybody was in the room. And it's funny because when you look back at like moments, you think, what the hell? Like, we were playing Westlife because she loved Westlife. Her and Niamh loved Westlife. And I just remember thinking, oh my God, why is Westlife playing? You know, these moments of really weird things that you're thinking in your head, but it was beautiful.
But for you, when you went in that morning, you got the call, did you realize like, this is it, that she's going to die?
That was the point.
Yeah.
That was the point. I was shaken. I was petrified. It was like an out of body experience, you know. That call changed everything. You know, it's before that and after that, life is just, you know, yourself. It's two worlds. Mm. And you walk into that hospital and it was like it wasn't happening. It was like I was standing there, my body was there, and it wasn't happening. Like, it just, and you know, I'm sure lots of people feel like this, but you want to go back to that time because, like, even the things that I was doing and saying, just, I was very much like A to B of like, okay, so we do this and everybody stand here. And I wasn't really me. Like, I wasn't even emotional the way I would be. You know, I obviously cried, but like, I wasn't taking it in. None of us were. It was surreal. They medicated her really well. They helped her, you know, move through the process very well. And she eventually stopped breathing. And we were all there around her, surrounding her with love. Like, she couldn't have had more love in the room. It was beautiful. It was really beautiful. But, you know, she was 61. She was too young and too full of life. She just wanted to live so much. And she'd so much to live for, you know. She waited her whole life for grandkids and it was just really hard. But it was beautiful too. And the next few days were beautiful in a as beautiful as they can be, you know, a funeral. We're from a very small village, Clemessin, and like, it was just so typical of Ireland. You know, there was sandwiches being brought to the door. There was, can we do this? Can we do that? Like, the sister, her sister-in-laws, they literally turned the house into into a funeral home like that. Came in the door and there was furniture moved, there was a sandwich and tea set up. Everything was perfect, just how Mom wanted it. And the funeral came and it was amazing. The wake was, I never experienced anything like it. She wanted to be dressed in her outfit that she wore to my wedding, which was stunning. She looked beautiful. She looked so beautiful and she looked peaceful. She was always gasping for breath and she looked strained. So her face was so peaceful and I wasn't expecting that. I wasn't expecting to see her like that. It was beautiful. And we were trying to decide whether we'd let the grandkids in to the funeral and stuff like that. You have to make these hard calls and whether it's appropriate. And we decided that we'd let them come and see their nana. And it was difficult. Era and Fia had lost their mom, you know, so we had to take that into consideration. But it was beautiful. They came up the morning. They didn't come to the funeral. They came up that morning and they were at first a bit afraid. And we said, look, she's in there. You can go into her if you want or not. It's up to you. And as kids do, they got a bit curious and they peeked their nose in. And then next thing they were playing around her and they were telling her that she was beautiful and they were writing little cards and stuff like that. And that was lovely. Like, Mom would have loved that. Mm. That would have been amazing for her. So the funeral was beautiful. We did a lovely day at it, really. And it was difficult for Dad, you know, to bring him into it. I'd mentioned earlier, he had been diagnosed with bipolar. He was doing quite well up until this point. He's on great medication and he went through, you know, a very hard time throughout his life getting to that diagnosis. But he was on medication and he was doing very well. And we were all worried about him because Mom and Dad were like, Nancy and Sid, is that what I'm going to call them? Like, they were like chalk and cheese, killed each other, loved each other, couldn't live without each other. That kind of vibe. And we didn't know where this was going to go with Dad. We were really worried about him. But he was good through the funeral. He was very good. He did himself proud. Like he held himself together and more so than I thought. And then he had a little accident afterwards. Many accidents he's had. We were laughing. We think Mom's cursed him. But yeah, he fell off a ladder anyway and he'd cut his head and he was staying with me for the few days afterwards. And he hadn't been left alone since Mom died. Every day one of us was with him or he'd be in my house, staying in my house. And this particular day, it was 2 weeks after Mom died. He said, look, I want to go home. Like, you know, I think I need to go home. And, you know, he's a grown man. I was worried about him, but also I was like, he's grieving his wife. I can't just keep him here. Like I can't keep him under lock and key. And we all agreed as a family that it was good for him to go home and we would do check-ins. So it was agreed that we would do these check-ins with him and make sure that he was okay. And he agreed he would phone us, you know, or he'd answer the phone. And this was on the Sunday. That was fine. He was at home answering the phone, doing what we'd asked him to do. My Auntie Joan, his sister-in-law, called up with dinner. She said he was doing good. He was watching the football. You know, obviously he was shaky. He was not, like, he just buried his wife. But nothing like crazy or whatever. Mm. It transpired then we were calling him that evening. There was no answer. And I started to get a bad feeling about it, like, you know, because he had been answering the calls. And I said to Kieran, like, this, you know, what should I do? And Kieran was like, look, just go call out to the house. I live 15 minutes out there. Just call out. Because I had a bad feeling, you know, like one of those horrible feelings in the pit of your stomach. I was like, something's wrong here. I rang my sister and she was like, I'll go out. And she's 15 minutes the other side. And I said, look, no, I'll go. And also, intuitively, as a baby sister, like, she's not a baby, she'll kill me saying that now, but she's, you know, I wanted to protect her because I had a bad feeling that I was going out to see something, if you know what I mean, and that I was going to find something or whatever. So I said, I'll go first. So got out to the house, couldn't get in the door, was ringing him, there was no entry, like, I couldn't get in. Went around to the back of the house and his window was open because he loved, he'd never wear a jacket, like, he just loved fresh air, whatever, you know. And I looked in the window and he was on the ground and I was screaming at him to get up. I thought, you know, maybe he's had a fall or something, and there was no answer. He wouldn't get up and I climbed in the window and I was shaking. My whole body was shaking, everything. Like, I just thought, is he dead? Like, what's going on? My mind wasn't going quick enough to pick up what was going on. He was unconscious. The first thing I did was ring Kieran. I still don't know why I'd done that, but I did that first anyway, because I panicked and I rang Kieran and he said, look, you ring the ambulance, I'll get someone to you. And I rang the ambulance and I tried to keep him, you know, get him into recovery, make sure that he was trying to unblock his airways. And like he was gone and, you know, I thought he was gone. But my uncle then, Carl, my mom's brother, arrived out, you know, 10 minutes later. I don't remember the time. It's all very blurry. But he arrived out anyway with his son. And the ambulance was taking ages. You know, we're out in the country and we're like, what are we going to do? Like this time frame here is imperative. Like I knew that we just needed to get him to the hospital if we'd any chance of saving him. So quickly just decided between the three of us, Carl and his son Noah, we're going to bring him in the car. Like, and at that point, we just had to throw caution to the wind. Maybe not medically the right thing to do. We didn't know what was wrong in terms of, we didn't know, you know, what was the right thing to do here. But intuitively, we carried him out into the car and we drove to the hospital.
Was he breathing?
Very faint, okay. In and out.
There was a pulse?
Yeah, but it was...
He didn't come back around. He was unconscious.
No, he was unconscious, like...
Something I've been thinking about a lot lately is how grief lives in our body. It's not just in our minds. It settles into your chest, your shoulders, your stomach. It can feel so heavy. And I know that stuck feeling because I was stuck for years myself. The only thing that helped me begin to lift myself out of that hole, even a tiny bit, was movement. But I had to go really gently at the beginning. I just had no motivation to get up and do a workout. That's why I wanted to share something that might help. It's called EcoFitness, and it's a beautiful, gentle online movement space created by Corina Duffy. Corina's been at rock bottom herself, and so she's created this with people like you in mind, especially if you're grieving or going through something hard. This isn't about pushing yourself or chasing big fitness goals. I imagine that's the last thing on your mind at the moment. It's for the days when you're in your pajamas or maybe even in tears. It's about moving just enough to feel a tiny bit better, to reconnect with your body in the gentlest way. EcoFitness gives you 4 live 30-minute gentle workouts each week, a full on-demand library, and thoughtful coaching messages to help build small, healthy habits, especially through life's tougher moments. Corina is offering the listeners to this podcast a 30-day free trial of her app, and I'd really encourage you to just give it a try. There's a link in the show notes. Just click through to get started. You can cancel anytime, no pressure, just an invitation. If you're feeling stuck, this could be a gentle place just to begin. So visit the show notes, click on the link and give it a go.
He was gone. Like, I know this sounds really strange, but I felt like he wasn't there. Like his spirit had gone.
Okay.
Like I just felt he was gone. We got him into the hospital and thankfully we did that because number one, we saved him from going to Drogheda, which was great for us in terms of like Navan. We knew everybody in Navan. We'd been there. It felt comfortable for us. We knew the doctors, the nurses. Mom had been in there so many times and we just felt safe. It was instant safeness, this safe feeling. And also it would have been really tricky down the line, other things that came afterwards. But they got him in anyway and they put him, he was on kind of life support in ICU. He was in the bed opposite Mom. You know, my sister, in fairness, she rang them and she was like, don't put them in the same bed as Mom. Like, just don't, you know, like that would have been horrific. 2 weeks later, we're all in this ICU room again and in the waiting room. It was surreal. It was surreal. I can't even explain to you how unfathomable it was. It was just really strange. All his brothers come in and this went on for, again, time seems to, I don't know, but it was 24 hours, maybe 48 hours. And it was very bad. They were like, this is very serious. We don't think he's going to come back. He had taken an overdose and they didn't think he was going to make it. So they said, look, we need you to make a decision about his supports. And at that point, we as a family had to sit and discuss this. That was really hard, you know, because he had essentially made a choice in his head, you know, 2 weeks after Mom dying, and he had had such a very hard mental health battle. Like this is, we're talking 30 years of in and out of hospitals, getting electric shock treatment, like back in the day, very difficult. He was quite very resilient man. And we just thought, if this is it, if this is the way he's supposed to go with Mom, maybe it's maybe we can't take that choice. Like, maybe we can't take that away from him. So we said, look, you know, if that's what you think is medically right, you know, we support that as a family. All his brothers, mom's brothers. We were a big family unit, but we'll give it a bit of time. And we did give it a bit of time. And then, you know, time went on and another doctor came in and said, you know what, like, I think he might pull through. We don't know what damage, but he might. So we'll leave that. And we did. And I remember going out to the car. I hadn't slept. Like, me and Eve had been awake all night, like, because we'd been in the hospital. I went out and had a sleep. But I remember going into him. And as I said, his spirit was gone. I felt like he was gone. But went to the car. And when I came back from the sleep, maybe 20 minutes later, it was like he was there. It was like, now, he wasn't awake or anything. But I went to the nurse. I said, is he okay? She goes, his stats have come up. She's like, we can't believe it. The doctor's coming around. But I felt it. Like, you could feel he was back in the room. It was really, really spiritual. Very strange. And when he came through, he said that he'd seen Sharon, Aidan's ex-partner, standing at the bottom of the bed. Because you're always interested to know what people might see if they're dying or they're close to death. And I thought maybe mom might be there, but it was Sharon. And he said that, you know, she was kind of guiding him back. And I often think, is it because she left her kids unexpectedly and she didn't want him to leave us? You know, you just, you hypothesize about these things, but that's what we thought. And anyway, he thankfully recovered from that. It was a long road. It was tough. I was on maternity leave heading back to work. My work were amazing. They were so good to me. I'm in a recruitment agency for nearly 9 years, Hayes. They're so good. They were amazing. And I had that support, but we needed that because dad was, you know, dad needed a lot of care after that. We were worried about him. But when he came through, the thing that I think is important is that he was happy to be here. He was happy that he woke up. And what had transpired afterwards was that through the few days of the funeral, he had forgotten to take some of his medication.
Okay.
So that was something none of us were checking. And that's going back to my mom, how she was always worrying about him. And I used to slag her and be like, oh my God, like, he's not a baby. Like, why are you worrying about him all the time? And now I know, if I could take mom back and give her a hug and say, I know, because, you know, that's become our worry now. We make sure, because he's a man, you know, not that he just forgets sometimes or whatever, but particularly around a funeral, there's a lot going on. Mm. We're all in autopilot. He was just surviving. He wasn't, like, now he's doing it all himself and he's great. But that was, he was used to having her there saying, Phelan, did you take your medication? Mm. Did you take your morning? Did you take your evening?
Mm.
So that was definitely a contributing factor.
Was but it?
Yeah, for sure. So he then pulled through, as it were, started to recover. And yeah, he was doing better. He had a bit more of a love for life, you know.
So when your dad, I suppose, made a recovery and got home and stuff, or even before that, did he have conversations? Obviously, you said he was glad that,
yeah,
he hadn't been successful.
Yeah.
But, you know, did he touch any more on, I suppose,
what happened?
What led him or that moment?
So there's a couple of things to it. It's very hard and it's really important for people to understand with men. I think it is a thing with men, particularly of his age bracket as well. He's not in the era of, let's talk about your feelings. He's in the era of, if I got a few pints into him, we'd have a chat, like. So we have had many conversations since then. Mm. He said that he just missed, he would say, your mom, you know, he'd never call her Ada, he just called her mom. We all called her mom. He just said, I missed your mom and I just couldn't imagine life without her. And I just felt that, what's the point? And he didn't know how he would survive. He didn't know how he would function without her. And to be quite frank, none of us did. Because he relied on her for everything.
Mm.
Now, obviously, through her illness, she started to rely on him, which was really weird because she was just this force. You know, she just looked after everybody. She was a real, you know, she was just that type of person. So, yeah, to answer your question, he that was why. And he said that, you know, I kept asking him. I'd have often talked to him and say, look, you know, if you feel like that again, can you talk to him? But it's petrifying fear that we have, you know. It's
just, that was my next question. Are you now left?
Oh, absolutely. I called out to him. Me and my sister are on the phone to each other all the time. Have you heard from Dad? The phone, and Dad's a devil with the phone. He hasn't got a clue with the phone. The phone could be turned off and he wouldn't know it. And we can't get through to him. We've often drove out to the house when the phone was off and he's sitting in the kitchen having a cup of tea and we're like, oh, thank God he's okay. Do you know, it's that worry will never go. I have it ingrained in me. And, you know, the trauma of finding him is, I've blocked that somewhat, but it's resurfacing in everyday worry. Do you know, like I am worried about him, but he is doing better. Don't get me wrong, but he's very good with taking his medication. He's, you know, we're all aware of that as well. We check it. We make sure because he's on his own. It's hard. He's in a big, lovely country house by himself, but he lives in, as I said, Clemessin. He goes and has his few pints. It's like a man shed and they're amazing. You know, he's got good people around him. His sister-in-laws are good to him. His brothers, everyone's very good to him. They're all aware of everyone got a fright, you know. Yeah. So yeah, it's been really difficult to keep him going. Do you know? Yeah,
it's crazy.
Yeah,
to think. So did you find your mum's grief was kind of put on hold?
Yeah,
I mean, it's 2 weeks after the funeral.
We didn't grieve at all. Like we didn't grieve, and then this next bit further took her grief away as well. We had in that year as well, my husband, to give context, he had been diagnosed with an autoimmune condition. It affects his spine. Your spine can fuse together if you don't get right treatment. It's called ankylosing spondylitis, AS it's called. And he got, that was, just a in the background little thing that was going on. But he was taking biologic medication and, you know, that's really helped him. And his dad also throughout 2023 as well, he started to have serious health issues and he also got diagnosed with an autoimmune condition as well.
The same one?
No, a different one, vasculitis. It's a different one. But there was an awful lot of stress for Kieran's family. They went through so much. So it was like on both sides of the family, there was just so much going on. Like there was just so much. And his granny had died as well. It was just crazy. There was a lot going on both sides. But you'll understand why I'm giving you context to that. But we were going on a holiday in November and we were really looking forward to this holiday. I was like, get me out of here. We need to go away. And mom had seen me book this holiday. She had said, you need to get a holiday, you know, because I've been sick and you need to just get away. So we'd booked Lanzarote and we were going as a family of four, myself, Kieran, Indy and Dylan. And the night before we went, there was an outbreak of a bug. We went to a christening and there was an outbreak of a bug. All the kids got sick, which is, as you know, as a parent, was an absolute nightmare. Indy was up all night getting sick and we were like, will we make this flight at all? Got on the plane and Indy was getting sick. Dylan was getting sick. We thought we'd never get off the flight. It was absolutely
stuff of nightmares there.
Literal nightmares. And I was after packing so badly, probably. I overpacked for the kids, didn't pack for us on the plane. So here's the kids, you know, getting sick on top of me and Kieran, and we'd no clothes to get changed into. They had loads. No. So the holiday was a disaster. Indy quickly recovered after 24 hours. She was fine. And it was great. She was like, not bothering her, but Dylan really didn't recover. He was 5-6 days, very sick, couldn't eat. Thank God we got an apartment and an all-inclusive. He just stayed in the apartment. He was getting sick all the time. He just couldn't keep food down. So we were just like, this is a bit strange. You know, they had the same thing and Indy's not recovering, or Indy's recovered quicker. And it just seemed a bit funny. That's grand. We get on with the holiday. We tried to enjoy it as best we could, but it was kind of terrible. Get home. Swear we're never going on a sun holiday and off we popped. That was kind of it, boxed off. But it wasn't, because Dylan just, there was little small subtleties in his, he was tired, he was fatigued. Kieran had noticed when he was brushing his teeth one evening that when he pressed his tummy against the sink, he was wincing. Very small things that you're not really like, not huge, big alarming things. And probably the biggest thing was there was a small bit of blood in his poo, very small. Again, it was very hard to detect, but Kieran's really like on the detail and he's great for stuff like this in terms of like, he'll push for things. And he was up and down to Crumlin getting tests. And we were waiting to see what these results were. And we thought it was going to be some food allergy. Like I was thinking celiac, or maybe it's, you know, like gluten intolerance or something like this, or, you know, dairy, or I don't know. That's what we were thinking. But on a Friday, I was coming home from work and I was getting the bus home and we were due to get these results, I know. But I wasn't expecting the call as such. I was on Nassau Street and Kieran rang me and he said, are you near home? And I knew by the tone of his voice, I've had so many of these calls that you're quite prepped for that something bad's happening. So I said, look, Kieran, you know, I was pretty sure he went. I said, you're telling me I'm not getting on this bus. You need to tell me what's going on here because I can't travel home in this bus. And he said, he just started crying. He said, Dylan's got a liver disease, a rare liver disease. And I lost it. I was like roaring crying. I couldn't understand what he was saying. I said, what does that mean? What are you saying? And it's an autoimmune condition. It's autoimmune hepatitis. It's a liver condition. It's very rare. He's very young. He's only 5 at this point. So I have to get on the bus to go home. And I was just, it was horrific. You're Googling. I'm literally on the bus Googling this the whole way home and trying to understand what it is, trying to piece together what it is, but also trying to be like, no, it's okay. It's okay. Because my brain at this point is going, I'm reaching for hope. I'm reaching for, no, it's not that bad, you know, but I was hysterical on the bus. And my Carl rang me, my uncle, said, like, we're like brothers, huge families. He's my uncle, but like a brother. Mm. He rang me and he said, what's wrong? He couldn't make sense of what I was saying. He said, where are you getting the car? I said, Dalgan Park or whatever. And he said, I'll collect you. You can't drive home. And I couldn't. I was shaking. Like, he brought me home. And that started the next 6 months of just, we were just not, we didn't know what we were heading into. That was Christmas. Then we found out the autoimmune, they told us he needed a liver biopsy and a bowel scope. And that was over Christmas. And I mean, as you can imagine, this is the first Christmas without mom. And as I'd told you about Christmas and my mother, we were all dreading it. Like, I mean, dreading it. We were going to have Christmas in our house, in the home house, and I was going to cook dinner. And none of us wanted to be there. Every Christmas, all the brothers came to our house. Everyone came, mom's brothers. It was the kind of focal point. No one wanted to be there mm-hmm. on Christmas Day. And I certainly didn't want to be there knowing that my son had some rare liver disease. But we got through it and we were waiting for the tests after Christmas, during Christmas. It was a horrific experience for Dylan. He had to take that fluid stuff, for getting a colonoscopy, you know, that mm-hmm. stuff that you have to mm-hmm. do. Mm-hmm. He did that once and then he got COVID and they said he couldn't do it. And we're like, he can't do this again. Like, he was like 5 telling him to drink this. Like, I remember my mom getting it and she used to be terrified doing it because it's really hard to drink and it's really awful. So he eventually got that done and they did the liver biopsy and they did a bowel scope and they rang us again and they said, look, he's actually got a bowel disease as well, inflammatory bowel disease, mm-hmm. which would later transpire to be ulcer colitis.
Yeah.
So there was that and we were just getting our heads around it. We were just like, and it was so weird. Like we were so heartbroken at the first one. Now there's the second one. We were just kind of like knock after knock after knock and we were having consultations about medication and we kind of got ourselves settled at that point and the medication and what we were doing. He was going to go on steroids and different things like that. And then there was a third autoimmune condition after a few more blood tests. And that was the worst one out of the three, the most detrimental because it affects the bile ducts. So it's autoimmune sclerosing cholangitis. And basically it's like a child version of PSC and it's very complex to treat.
What's PSC?
That's primary sclerosing cholangitis. So there's an adult version kind of, and then
okay.
a child version kind of.
Okay.
It's very complex actually. But the medication, there is no medication. There's no treatment, no cure. It basically just gets progressively worse. So.
Is it life limiting?
Yeah. Like, so now it's not, right? The second. None of them are in terms of fatigue. He suffers with fatigue, toilets kind of situations and that kind of thing. But they're all progressive chronic illnesses. Mm. And that's why I mentioned his dad and Kieran's autoimmune because they can be genetic. They're not linked, mm-hmm. but they can be genetically bound as well as environmental factors. But the third one affects the bile ducts. So basically the bile ducts protect your liver, the toxins going in and out your liver. Mm. And over time they erode. And what can happen is you can get cirrhosis, liver cirrhosis and a liver transplant. And like he's only
A little thing.
Only a little thing. And you're like, how, like, he was honestly, like, the specialists in Crumlin, they all know us. Like, they've talked about his case. He's quite well known in Crumlin because he's so young. It's completely rare.
Yeah.
It's completely rare. My mom used to just idolize him. Like, I went through a phase of being like, how could she let this happen to him? Like, I know that sounds so ridiculous, but that's what I was thinking. And then I thought, I flipped it on its head, as I did with everything. You know, I was like, he's going to be fine. You can't go to the worst here, because the worst doesn't always happen. So, and that's what we did. We got,
but there's a real,
on with it.
Sorry, there's a real grief there.
Oh, yeah.
The loss of your child's health, I suppose. His full, clean bill of health, that you now have to be taking medication, hospital appointments, that he might struggle with physical symptoms. Like, you obviously were devastated for him.
It was, Kieran lost his life. He, like, you know, he lost his life with it. I think I was numb. I think because mom had died.
And maybe still.
Dad. Yeah. And so I, recent. Like, it's so recent. Like, yeah. I'm, you know, I laugh more than I cry at the minute. It's so hard. Everything is hard.
Yeah.
But what I think the hardest part for us is it's the unknown and the future. And like what you just said, you bring kids into the world. And, you know, I've listened to your podcast where other people have come in, they've talked about, and that's why I want to do this, is because there's perspective there. There's so many kids that come into this world and they are sick and they have detrimental illnesses. And I just kept thinking, we have to look at the positives here. And I think probably annoyed Kieran a lot, because that's my default, is like, right, where can I find the positive? But he needed to grieve. He was struggling. Like, I was in my mom's mode.
Yeah.
I was in, like, I looked at my mom. I watched my mom grow up with trauma, you know, her brother died as well, and her mom died young, and her father eventually died, and all the things were her kids with Niamh and the accident and dad being sick. There was so much for one person, but she just always pulled up her big girl pants, as she used to say, and she used to just get on with it. And I seen her doing that, and I was like, that's me. I'm just going to slot into who she was, and that's fine. But I knew she had a mental breakdown later on in life with that, because you can't, that's not, like, it's not achievable to do that. It's not sustainable, sorry, to do that.
It's not healthy either.
It's not healthy, but it's
a coping mechanism.
Yeah. And I see women do it all the time. It's a coping mechanism. You've got two kids. I don't have time to be lying in my bed crying. I've got a 3-year-old that's mommy wants me every minute of the day. So I didn't have that. But it was really tough, because there was a sense of why us, which, you know, why now? Why us? Why Dylan? And that was that. And we dealt with it. Life got back into kind of a groove. And I'm really proud of how we just pulled it together. Me and Kieran had really tough time together trying to figure this out, both having different ways of dealing with it. And as I said, he probably hated me a lot because I was trying to do, you know, pull through, and he was probably trying to sit with it, and we had different ways of dealing with it, but ultimately came together to figure it out.
Interesting what you're saying there as well about you being so different to your husband in terms of the way you were handling it. But I guess, you know, you have to take into account that you had just lost your mom, because it's extremely difficult for anyone who has had a recent bereavement of someone that, you know, it can have such a mental effect. You get so worried that you're going to lose somebody else that you can almost block everything out. So how someone responds to another trauma, or, like, you know, and not alone that, but then your dad. And, like, I think the way you react might have been very different even before your mom had passed.
True.
You know, it's very different, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I think you're right. Like, you've hit the nail on the head. I think
you're like, I'm not even going there.
I can't.
Can't cope with that.
Yeah, like, me and my sister were talking about it last night. And she's like, I'm probably not going to listen to the podcast. She's like, I can't even go there. Aww. Like, she can't, like, she's not able to open the box. And I get it, because it's so painful.
Yeah.
It is so painful. Yeah. Like, we're 2 years on from mom passing away, and it's got worse, if that's even possible.
Mm-hmm.
It's got worse, because your everyday life, everyone gets back to normal. And nobody's asking you really anymore at this point, oh, how are you after your mom? It's gone. You know that with your sister. Mm-hmm. It's gone. But you're living with constant memory. You're living with you're making dinner and you're like, oh, I wonder how mom would make, oh, I can't ring her. And I've went to ring her so many, I'm sure you've done that. Like I've went to ring her so many times, or I've woken up in the morning and for a split second, she's alive. Oh, she's dead.
Mm.
And she was my best friend. She was our best friend, like my brother and sister. Like we rang her, we were on the phone to her all the time. Like I'd spend hours on the phone to her and dad would be like in the background going, Ada, like, come on, like you've been on, what are you talking about? Kieran would be the same. What, like, what could you possibly be talking about? So it's that. It's that. It's that dealing with the grief and the aftermath of that and just not, like, you're not fully connected. I don't think I'm fully plugged into life, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You're kind of here and you're operating. And I've, don't get me wrong, I've got amazing friends and I go out and I socialize and I have a laugh. I love laughing because that's what mom, like, you know, with synopsis with. But you're still not fully, there's a missing chip there.
Mm-hmm.
There's something in the background that's not fully connected into life. And when you go to sleep or you're in the car or when you can have that, you know, because you don't get much time with two kids, they're the times that you connect into the grief and you think about, you know, what does this mean? And then you switch it off and you get back out of the car and you do whatever.
Mm.
But yeah, life kind of got back to normal a little bit after that. We coped with it. We got on with it. And in 2024, we got a beautiful surprise. I found out I was pregnant and it was a huge surprise for us because Indy, our little girl, was a miracle baby. We tried for 4 years, I think it was, to have her. We did 3 rounds of IVF and my mom went through this whole journey with me and it was so nice that Indy came when she was alive because she seen me go through a lot of pain with that. And she had given my sister a gift of a baby 3 weeks after she died as well. Niamh got pregnant 3 weeks after, you know, all that dealing. And that was very tough for her because we were dealing with dad stuff and she got pregnant. And Niamh had told mom in the hospital, I think we're going to start a family. Not start a family, have another baby because she'd had Arthur. And next thing she finds out, she's pregnant 3 weeks later. So I firmly believe that was a gift from her. So I felt this was her little gift to me and that I was ready at this time because I had to go through all that. So I was, you know, delighted. We were so excited. But I was kind of like you said, I was still a bit like, you know, waiting for something bad to happen.
Mm.
And my body probably wasn't ready. I wasn't feeling well. I was struggling in work. I work, you know, in a busy recruitment role. And my brain fog, I just couldn't. Like everyone was just, but I thought early pregnancy. And you know, it's so hard because you can't tell anyone. Not that you can't, but you know, you don't tell anyone in work or whatever. I started to have some bleeding and I panicked because I never had bleeding before. Rang the rotunda and they said, look, you know, it could be fine. Do you know, it's not much, it could be fine. That didn't really reassure me. I was petrified. So went for a scan. It was 11 and a half weeks, I think, at this point. So it was fairly like, you know, you were
coming up to that 12 week.
Yeah, we were thinking about car changes, we were thinking about names, we were thinking about, you know, like we really ran ahead with it. We were like, you know, I was thinking about all the things. I was straight into, again, Ada, my mom mode of like writing out lists. I need this, I need this, I need to save for this. Like I was just, you know, doing all that. And then I wasn't expecting this at all. Like I just, and that's the thing about, you know, miscarriages is that you just think it happens to other people sometimes. And I'd heard other people. And I also feel so ashamed and bad that I didn't understand. My friend had them and I just didn't understand what that was and how it felt to be 11 and a half weeks pregnant, go in and have a scan and they tell you there's no heartbeat. I was just like, and do you know what my instant reaction was? I remember lying there and I was like, can I go now? So me, like, so difficult of me. Can I go? Like, can I get up? And Kieran's like, just, you know, like, and I go and I just ran to the toilet and I got out of there as quickly as I possibly could. I couldn't wait to get out of there and go, right, okay, we'll just close that door. And I was already closing the door thinking about what I was making for dinner tonight. You know, that kind of, it was weird. But they came back, I had to go back anyway. And they said, look, we are going to offer you surgery because you're so far gone that that's the appropriate route. But you can go medical if you want, but we would advise surgery. Mm. And I said, okay, what's the date? Whatever, you know, get me ducks in a row. Okay, it's this date. And it was the 2nd of May. And that was my mom's anniversary.
Oh God.
Her first one. I thought, no, I just said, hell no. I was like, this, I can't take anymore. I can't be in a hospital the day my mom died, you know, to think of it like, mom died that day a year ago and now I'm losing another life. Like, do you know what I mean? In a way, or whatever way you want to feel that means to you, but that's what it meant to me. So I said, no, I'll take the medical route. And they gave me the tablets and off I went. And again, I didn't really think about it. I just thought, I'll take these tablets and that'll be the end of it. And, you know, I'll get on with my life. Like, I was very matter of fact about it. But it was horrific. It was 2 days of pain and labour. And eventually I had the miscarriage. And it was just, oh, it was just horrible, horrible. And the feeling of emptiness and just, you know, what was that all about? What was that for? And I did have a bit of a breakdown then. I took 3 weeks off work. I had mom's anniversary and I just took the 3 weeks because I kind of went back to work very quickly after dad had done that and mom. I was supposed to go back for maternity, but I went back too soon. And I just, at that point, was like, I can't. And my work were incredible. My director in work, she was dealing with her husband dying at the time from MND. She was amazing because she understood what I was. She'd understood the trauma that I'd had. So there was, you know, there was that lovely kindness there.
Mm.
But yeah, that was kind of it then. And since then, it's been trying to find a way back to happiness and, you know, some form of like normality. And but the thing is, you know, I just keep thinking how grateful I am. I keep thinking how grateful I am to have Indy. She was a miracle. How grateful Dylan's thriving, really. He's doing well right now. I can't tell you what he's going to do next year, the year after, but nobody can. We can't predict the future. So you have to stay in the present.
Mm.
I can't go 10 steps ahead and worry about what's that going to be like next year. So I find myself now, the only way that I can be happy is to stay here. It scares me to think about Dylan in his, you know, grown up, maybe not being able to get a house, mortgage, can't get a mortgage with 3 autoimmune, might need a liver transplant, might not be able to work, you know, could die very young. Like, you know, you can't go there.
Mm.
You know, my husband likes to go there because he's very practical. He's like,
yeah, there's nothing wrong.
He's amazing. Like, he'll do
that either. Is there?
Yeah. There's no right way. Exactly, there's no right way to cope with anything.
But even if you think of like maybe you, your sister, and your brother, when your mom, had her illness before it got advanced. Some of you might have went there in your own heads.
Yeah,
some of you may not, you know, but maybe she won't be here someday. Yeah. You know, I know when my sister was ill, you know, I very much was like straight into it. How long is she going to have left? What's it going to look like? She's probably going to die. I faced it. Other people were like, no, can't go there.
Yeah.
You know, it's very different for everybody, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's weird what you said there because I faced it with mom. With her, it was really weird. Like, I talked to her about that and I loved being that person for her because nobody would talk to her about it. Everybody, dad kept saying, you're grand, almost kind of like, you're grand, Ada. But I had so, like, that's kind of became a little thing that we had. We'd be like, so like, you know, the funeral, the plants or whatever. So I did go there with her. Like, I was very much in the detail. I love organizing things and being with her to help her through that. But I suppose I block things out. I blocked it out in some, I must have blocked it out. But I think the way you dealt with it, I think it is better to face it head on. I do think so.
I don't know. Is it? Who knows?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I think everything is as it should be. I think if a person's not able to go there, they're not able to go there.
And maybe, they shouldn't be pushed.
No.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have to meet yourself where you're at. Maybe there's a reason why you have to protect yourself.
Yeah.
Maybe you're not able to face it or work through it, you know?
Yeah.
But it's an awful lot, my God.
Yeah. It was a lot. And it's like we laugh about it. Like the humor that we had throughout all this was like the dark humor. Like we wouldn't have got through without it. It's so Irish. And I love that. I love that about families as well, the things, you know, there was jokes being cracked when dad was in hospital about, you know, because mom was 2 weeks previous. We said we might get a 2-for-1 with the funeral director because we hadn't paid it, you know. There was all this kind of stuff, which is not talked about that much with grief, but it's such an important part of it because laughing got us through it. And that's, you know, it's the banter that we have, you know, and I'm sure you had that as well through, you know. Because when you've got that much darkness, you can't have no light. There has to be some light.
Mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
And there has to be gratitude for it. Like, I'm just so grateful. I'm so grateful dad's still here. I'm so grateful the kids have now. The kids are obsessed with him. So I'm grateful for the family that we have. And I think in these times, and when you go through these times, it's nice to step back and think about what you have and how grateful you are for it. You know, like the time mom's funeral, the community we had, like we moved away from Clemessin, like my sisters, my brothers, and we came back and we were all like, geez, we want to buy a house in Clemessin because it's just such a lovely community. And the people that wrap their arms around you metaphorically in those times, like my friends, like I wouldn't be this positive or be this kind of like, you know, in a good mindset if I didn't have outlets like my friends and my family. And, you know, don't get me wrong, like there's days where, you know, I can't, you know, I was crying on the car here, you know, in my head talking about mom. And then I can talk about her, I'm fine. It's weird, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The way sometimes you're fine and then it can just hit you. And it's like, I was explaining to one of my friends, it's like you're in the sea and you're standing in the sea and next thing this huge wave comes and just knocks you out. You know, we've all been there, you know, you're standing in the sea and you're like, whoa. But the wave for grief for me is you don't know when you're going to come up from it. Like you don't know, is it going to be a 30 second wave? Is it going to be 2 minutes? Hopefully not, you'd be dead. But like, do you know what I mean? You don't know how long that grief's going to last for. And I found that for me, you just have to go with it. You have to let your body go with it. You have to let your mind go whatever day you're feeling and communicate that with people. It's okay to wake up. Like I say that to Kieran all the time. It's okay to wake up in the morning and be like, you know, I'm just not having a good day. Or I'll say to my manager in work or whatever, you know, I'm struggling. This reminded me of mom today. I'll message one of the girls or whatever and I'll have a bit of a cry and then, you know, make the dinner and everything. Mm-hmm. You know yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's what it feels like. And I guess like you're much further on the journey than me. I don't know, is that ebb and flow a bit easier, you know?
Yeah, I think it does. It's hard to say because it definitely does, but I feel like, is that just me? I don't know. Like, yeah. You know, I often say that, like people think, oh, you know, you're great. I wouldn't be here two years into it.
Yeah.
Like I found the second year super hard. I found the fourth year awful.
That's mad.
Yeah, I did.
What was it? Because people say the second year. I've had that loads of times and I found the second year. And that's when you're kind of supposed to be back into it, isn't it?
The way I described it when her fourth anniversary was, do you know when you've kids, you know when they're getting older and you almost start missing, I'm like, oh God. You're like,
yes, yeah, yeah.
You know they need to progress, yeah, and everything. And yeah, it's just like time was rolling on, but part of me wanted to stay fresh, if that makes sense.
No, it does. It does.
I wanted it to be like, yeah, yeah, this has just happened.
Like, this has just happened. And it's also, and it's like, you're physically getting further away
from
them.
Exactly, yeah. It's longer from the last time I've seen
you've hugged.
Yeah. And I kind of felt that. I remember on the fourth anniversary, I was like, what does this mean? Yeah. And I remember thinking, like, I think the world just feels like, oh, well, we're really advanced now. You know, we're well down the road here now. You're well graduated in your grief. Let's all move on. I felt that kind of loss almost, like as in I want to stay back. I want to be able to say to people, this just happened, but it hadn't just happened.
Isn't that mad?
And that's the way it just popped into my mind about, you know, the way when a child is turning 2 and 3 and 4 and you're delighted, but then you're also mournful of like, oh God, they're not just babies
anymore.
They're not
the babies. Yeah. It's so true.
Like that's the way I looked at it. But I got to be honest, it's very different now. Like her anniversary this year, last year, it didn't really...
Didn't affect you. Like,
no.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's just, well, I sit here all the time and I'm quite present.
Mm.
You know, I'm here because of her. That's my reason. Know, like,
but
you
isn't
know?
That amazing?
That's
like,
lovely.
Like your purpose and like I get, it's a very different purpose because what you're doing is phenomenal. Like there was a place for this because grief is not spoken about. Death is so, we're scared of dying. We're scared of what comes after it. But the community of Grief Ireland is people coming together and going, oh, it's not so, everyone feels the same. Because I felt lonely. And that's why, you know, all those things happened in those 2 years. I felt so lonely going, why me? But this happens all the time. You hear it all the time. You know, it's a ripple effect of trauma that comes together. That happens all the time. So it's not just me, but that's why this is important, because it opens a forum for that conversation. And you've changed that, because I just don't think it was there.
No.
But it's important.
I don't think it was either. I really don't think it was.
Wasn't.
And it is. It's so lonely, because you do feel like you're the only one. And it doesn't make it any easier. But in knowing that you're not the only one, like it helps in some small way to feel like you're not the only one.
Yeah, it does.
Going
yeah.
through the worst of the worst. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't necessarily help either.
No.
I guess you just get that comfort from that part of it, is that I'm not alone here.
Yeah.
Because being lonely is an awful thing.
It's an awful thing. And what I found with this is, and I think, you know, it's been mentioned before, but this is like therapy, you know. I'm not ready to do therapy. I'm definitely not. I tried it after maybe. I remember before I went to work, back into work, I booked in some counselings and I was like, right, I'm just going to package this off into my little grief box. And I did about three and I was like, no, this is not for me. And then my friend Laura obviously sent me the podcast, and every episode was like, crying in the car, in the kitchen, putting away shopping, putting away, crying with these people about their, you know, stories and about their losses. And it made me mourn mom and made me think about how lucky we are to love people that much, that it care, that it means so much to us, that we're, you know, listening to a podcast about grief, you know, because essentially you're saying, like, I was telling my friends about this. I was like, this is my favorite podcast. And like, it seems a bit macabre to be like, I love listening about grief, but it's not, because if you've lived it, it's suddenly interesting to you, because it's like, you know, some people might resonate with blocking out grief, some might resonate with dark humor, some might resonate with like heading up. So each person that comes on has a different way that they've coped, and then if you feel you've coped that way, you're like, oh, okay, I'm not
yeah, you for know? Sure. Oh, listen, thank you so much for coming in and telling me all about your wonderful mom. She certainly lives on.
Yeah.
You're so vibrant and full of life. And even though you've been through the lowest of the low and the darkest of the dark, you're continuing to shine. There's such a sparkle in your eye.
Thank you.
Which maybe can be deceiving sometimes, because
it can, but it is, I do generally feel mom wanted to live, right? She wanted to live. She loved her life. She loved her family and she loved her friends. And like, what other way can I honor her than by doing what she wanted me to do? She loved me as a person, the way I am, bubbly, you know, making connections with people, being happy. She fundamentally just wanted me to be happy. And that's where it's come from. Yeah, it's a choice. We have a choice.
Yeah.
And I can choose to let all these things drag me down, or I can go, how can I turn them into a purpose for me? You know, and I'm still trying to figure that out. I think with Dylan's things, the three autoimmune, I feel there's something there for myself and Kieran. There's a purpose there, and there's a purpose for Dylan, and we just need to figure that kind of path out. But yeah, thank you.
Thank you for coming, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks, Kathy.